So the title of my talk is Yesterday's Dinner, Tomorrow's Weather, Today's News. And I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors, Iris Chan and Kate Smith. So one part of addressing the problem of food contributions to climate change is identifying and quantifying it, as the prior speakers have spoken to so beautifully. And another part is creating awareness about it and the will to address the situation. And these two issues are interrelated, first of all, because one of the reasons that the message has been slow to get out is because of the challenge in creating a clear and streamlined message. On the flip side, in the absence of such a message, there's a concern that when messages do go out, they may not be the most appropriate ones. So this presentation describes an analysis of newspaper coverage of food and agriculture contributions to climate change. And for those of you who saw Sarah Jones present last night in her fantastic routine, she made fun of the idea of doing these kind of no-duh public health studies where everybody kind of knows what the answer is. But I think the importance of this study is by documenting the gap in coverage by measuring something you can, what's not measured is not managed. So I have no financial relationships that are relevant. So let me start with the context. We know that the public is increasingly aware and motivated to do something about climate change. This is a very recent ABC News study, and among those who were reported that they were currently doing something about climate change, the vast majorities were changing their energy consumption or reducing their use of gasoline. 5% said that they were buying local or organic or growing their own food. And it's an open question what they might have said about meat or whether some of those people fit into the 13%, but basically it's a much lower level of response and awareness. So we chose to look at newspapers, and recognizing that they are the media source of record and that they have a very broad readership. But of course, it's important to acknowledge that this is one among many sources from which the public receives information. But media plays a key role in raising awareness and shaping the issues that are considered to be important, and also identifying who's responsible for solving a problem and how the problem is framed. And there's also lots of evidence that news coverage is associated with behavior change. That said, there's also ample evidence that just knowledge about a problem doesn't mean you're going to act on it, and just intention to act doesn't mean you're going to act on it. But if you don't even know that it exists, then you're not going to do anything about it. And, so we wanted to know, first, what are the media presenting to the public, how much coverage is there, and who is framed as being responsible for action. And we did a formal media analysis, two coders, a Kappa analysis for consistency. We looked at 16 of the top 20 US newspapers, which is an unusually large sample for this kind of study. And these newspapers have a disproportionate policy impact. And we started collecting articles 3 months prior to the start of Inconvenient Truth in September 05 and went up through January 08. And so first we collected all articles that mentioned the word climate change in their first paragraph, and then we searched those for mentions of food, farm, or agriculture. We took out those that were mentioning the sort of flip side, how climate change would affect food, farm, or agriculture. We took out these sort of peripheral mentions like the word Farmington, Connecticut. Took that one out. So here's the very brief summary of what we found. Over these 29 months, 4,582 climate change articles, only 109 mentioned food contributions in any even peripheral way. 20, which is a 0.5%, were coded as having a substantial focus on the issue, which is being mentioned in more than 3 paragraphs. And 0.5% mentioned meat or dairy contributions. So just to remind you of what was just discussed, close to a third of greenhouse gas emissions worldwide may come from food. In the United States, there's one study that put it at 17%. Livestock production, 18% of world greenhouse gas emissions. And in the United States, it may be meat and dairy may be half of our food-related greenhouse gas emissions, but only half of the calculators mentioned this in any peripheral way. And so let me start with level of focus. Of these 109 articles, 45 of them mentioned food contributions to climate change in less than a paragraph. Many of these, it would be like a 5,000 word article, and somewhere in the article, they would list a bunch of different sectors, agriculture being one of them. So that's when you include 109 articles, that's a significant part of that. And 44 of them had a short mention, and 20 had a substantial focus. And over time, there was a very significant increase in the level of focus on food. And so in the first 14 months, there was only one article. Last 14 months, 19 articles. Here's a graph of articles by month. And on the left axis is the number of food and climate change articles. And the right axis has the total number of climate change articles in the yellow graph. And so you can see that the food and climate change articles basically follow along behind the climate change articles in terms of the trend. I sort of think of it as they wrote everything they could about climate change, and then they couldn't think of anything else to say, so maybe we'll write an article about food. Note here that we only get up to 10 articles in the highest peak month, and by the end, we're still only at 6. Let's look by newspaper. And here again, you see a pretty good trending of the food and climate change articles with the climate change articles. So this may be like the in particular editors or journalists may be particularly interested in this and following up on it. And that provides us with an opportunity. The New York Times was way out ahead of the curve. Numerous newspapers didn't cover it at all. Four had only one article, and two had zero. And this particular slide shows only the first half of the study, but this basic pattern continued in the second half of the study. So who was responsible for action? And the coders were allowed to code up to three parties as being responsible based on what the article seemed to imply as the responsible party. And in the first half of the study, overwhelmingly the articles were saying that individuals were the ones who could do something about it. And by the end, there was a movement towards government being the top party. So it's not to say that individuals, business, or government has more role to play from my perspective. I may have a perspective on that, but that there's a broadening of coverage and of the way these issues are thought about across time. And there's more to the study, but let me focus here on strengths and limitations. The biggest limitation is that we don't know how these newspapers reflect what's in other media. I will say that if you, like me, are getting lots of email forwards of these types of articles, you may think that there's really a significant increase since January 08 when we stopped doing this analysis. And I would just say that throughout the process of doing the research, we kept thinking, well, now there's been a huge increase because we just got all these forwards. And then when we actually extended it a little bit further, we found that there actually even wasn't any substantial increase. And again, we ended with 6 in our highest month. We may have missed some articles, and there's a subjectivity in the coding. The strengths are the large newspaper sample, using these kind of standard methods, and the multiple lines of evidence that we brought together. What's going on? Why has there been so much less coverage of food contributions compared to other aspects of climate change? And I'll point to four key factors that I identified, and you may have other ideas. First is the history. The food was relatively late to be recognized, and so many of the climate change experts were focused in other areas already. And I think there's also a sort of history of what might be called a carbon dioxide bias, where in the food system, methane and nitrous oxide are really important greenhouse gases. But when somebody, a reporter, saw something about methane or nitrous oxide, it might not have triggered them to think about this in a substantial way. Second, we don't have as clear a message at this point about what should be done and what consumers should do and what the exact interventions are. Third, the environmental advocacy groups that have played such a major role in getting news coverage about climate change traditionally were less focused. And I have to say that this has really been changing very much over the past few months' time. But there is a history of expertise, and there was also a history of having sort of target industries that they had developed oppositional relationships with, and that they kind of had that connection to, and they understood those industries. And so there was less focus on the food industry. There was also many people within the environment field feeling that they didn't want to alienate the public. You know, it's one thing to say, get one of those twisty light bulbs, and it's another thing to say, get rid of your Big Mac. And they didn't want to confuse people. And finally, I think food issues are very frequently framed as being individual and as not having policy import. And when it doesn't have policy import, it's less newsworthy. There are some real opportunities to increase the coverage of this, and I think that hopefully we in public health, because of the strong public health co-benefits, I think there's a major role for the public health community to get out there in front of this message and drive it along. Reporters need an angle on climate change. There's so many different ways that we can frame that message in ways that newspapers like to hear it. We can talk about health. We can talk about the consumer interest angle. We can tell it as a story. We can go local and take the reporter out to a farm. We can and should start looking into conflict with the food production industries and food processing industries and agribusinesses. And I think that we should be challenging them. And I don't want to say that conflict in a negative sense, but we should be challenging them to look closer at their practices and investigative pieces and so on. I think that there's an opportunity because the environmental advocacy groups are increasingly interested, although I would also note that there's been no sign of any ever mention of this issue from Al Gore's camp to date that I'm aware of. Finally, we need to be vigilant because we've seen that a lot of the transportation and energy industries have really sought to control the message about climate change and put their spin on it. And as more and more challenges to them come up on food issues, they may also try and control that message in ways that we would not agree with as well. So in conclusion, there's low awareness, low coverage, and it's not always what we would want to say. Great opportunity, great need to do something about it, and we must remain vigilant as coverage increases. The information gap contributes to the action gap, and action is urgent. Thank you. Can I just point out two things? And there's plenty of resources in the back, but I wanted to mention in particular, the Food and Climate Research Network is a group out of the UK, and they have a vast store of resources on their website, including a very broad, comprehensive new literature review. And we do have a Google group of people that are interested in networking on food and climate work within the US.
I would just add that there's a kind of a compendium or a list of resources that includes this group in the UK, as well as a whole host of others. So I would encourage you to grab one of those if you're interested. I am so excited to be here and hear public health folks talking about my issues. I can't tell you how kind of dispirited it is to go to meetings, particularly around funders who are funding in these areas. And I think part of it is that ag has kind of always been late invited to the party. Those are those Aggies, those are those people out in the fields. They're not terribly interesting. Oftentimes they stink, literally. But it's really... It's really nice to be at the party and to see other folks recognizing that. I've had a couple of instances where funders, I had a health professional at a foundation actually ask me to explain the connection between nutrition and agriculture. Unfortunately, I had a glass of wine in my hand so I could take a big sip before I had to answer that. I've had smart growth funders who are preserving land who didn't see the connection between the land that they're preserving, the agriculture that's being grown, and the farmers. Climate change people don't necessarily understand the ag, so this is really great. Open it up to questions. Yes, you in the black will go 1, 2, 3, 4. Could you stand up and let us know who you are as well?
My name is Margaret Mellon, and I'm a senior concerned scientist. And I think these are just excellent presentations. I'd like to just underscore the obvious, though, and that is that Clem's problem, the advocacy problem, in many ways all come back to the lack of fundamental data produced on the U.S. food and ag system. and that there is a desperate need for university community for language. And there are lots of ways to get it funded, but that is a core need. We cannot move ahead on an issue like this if we're always talking about data that come from other countries. And I think that once that data starts rolling in, those data start rolling in, they are the occasion for lots of other products and stories. The other thing I was going to say is that it's just because it's a major issue that all of us face, is that there are simply fewer and fewer reporters on any of the papers that you listed who are interested in our issues, and the ones who are now completely overwhelmed and have a very difficult time, A, even writing what their feet tell them they should be writing about, but certainly moving off into new areas. So looking for, thinking through all of this, through the media, the fact that it's no longer just papers, but also the fact that investigative reporting is being choked off to a degree that I just never seen happen.
I have a couple of quick comments. One is that I would encourage those of you who are getting funding from health foundations to encourage them to collaborate and to do that kind, to pay for that kind of research. There is a small growing group of funders who work in the sustainable ag and food systems realm, but you know, by comparison, the money is minuscule, even though it's growing, and they would love to be collaborating, and they could connect them up with the people who are doing the work. That said, also around the media issues, is that food and ag is now kind of the issue du jour, and there are actually quite a number of environmental reporters that are doing this work and that would love to have kind of the health angle as well, but don't have that access. There was a couple of other, yeah, Gail, sure. You want to come to them?
Oh, well, I don't have a big comment really, but when we started our food carbon footprint work, we were a little surprised that because it seemed to be right at the forefront that we were not getting a whole stream of funding. It has been way more difficult than I expected. So maybe some of your ideas about collaborating with the health community might pay off, but these are not cheap to get the data and do these process-based life cycle assessments.
There was a couple more questions over there, and then, yeah.
I had a question about the waste stream. And the summary of my question is, if I compost pile a good thing or not? You know, and I guess either big, large-scale or small-scale composting, and also the system to scavenge methane and the like, what kind of offset, you know, is that?
The other question is around compost. Is this compost pile a good thing or not? I would say definitely yes.
Yes, I would agree, although yeah. we don't have data on it, but it just the recycling piece, you know, where, like if food goes to landfills, it just emits methane and that's the end of it, and there's no benefit at all. So I would say definitely compost, and then that
scavenging.
Digesters. That's a positive thing, and that can take advantage of some of that. Yeah. Do you, any of you guys know about the?
Yeah. Just want to talk briefly about digesters. I think digesters on a small scale, particularly when you're talking about farm animal systems, are a wonderful thing. They can work really well. The problem, and I'm looking into this currently, so it's heavy on my mind, is large-scale animal factories or these CAFOs that I mentioned. When you're doing it on a large scale, it can perpetuate those systems, and it can also not do anything to reduce annual greenhouse gas emissions. So it's one of those things. There's no easy answer to it.
Did you?
Yeah, there is a large fruit and vegetable producer in Oregon, it's called Child Farms, and they recently are incorporating a methane digester as part of their harvesting energy from their waste products. So that's something they're putting online right now. It's under construction, but they're using basically the refuse from all of the various, you know, fruit and vegetable crops that they produce to basically power their preservation machines.
Yeah, there's actually quite a number of farms around the country that are doing similar kinds of things to Solish. There was a woman over here, and then Molly, and then you and you. Yeah, go ahead.
One of the speakers mentioned Michael Pollan, and in his most recent book, he actually offered a number of solutions to the food climate connection problem. One of them is gardeners needing to use more and more of their land to have urban gardens that we can raise food in. So I was wondering if in any of your research you're running across any data to see whether or not gardeners are joining that kind of movement in any significant way.
I haven't seen concrete research to quantify the numbers of that, but there's definitely, like, from review of the media, and the talk about doing that is really increasing. The talk about victory gardens and reinvigorating the victory garden movement is expanding. There's pressure on to actually have the president in the first 100 days in the White House plant a garden on the White House lawn, an organic garden. So I think that this movement is growing and that public health can help promote it. I also wanted to comment about Michael Pollan. I don't know if there's wide awareness of this, but since yesterday, there's been talk circulating through the blogosphere that Barack Obama actually is quoting from that farmer-in-chief piece that that Danny mentioned. So.
Molly, and then in the back, you, and then you.
I'm Molly Anderson, and I have a question probably for Gail and Danny about trade-offs, and it has some implications for the media messages that people are getting too. It really strikes me that there's confusion that's being generated about what people should do in what they're eating because of the way that research is being presented. And the two specific examples that immediately jump out are the studies about how eating locally grown foods is not as good because the greenhouse production, and it's based on these Scandinavian studies where there's a lot of greenhouse production and they're importing tomatoes from Spain. And then the other question is about livestock, and the message that gets out to people is you should be eating less meat. But a lot of the data on meat, the greenhouse gas emissions from meat, are conflating the emissions from capos with the emissions from rangeland beef production or grass-fed beef or more sustainable means of production. So the question, I guess, is whether you're aware of any studies that are looking at the effects of greenhouse production when it's hoop houses or greenhouses that are heated with biogas, methane digesters, some more sustainable means of season extenders, like the Elliott Coleman model. And then for livestock, whether you're aware of studies that are really pulling out what the emissions are for range-produced livestock versus capo-produced.
One of the things I didn't get to bring up in my talk is that there are studies that are comparing and quantifying how pasture and rangeland animals that are not confined are able to sequester more carbon and all the sorts of things that we would want from sustainable farm animal systems. Again, there's a huge lack of data. One of the constant struggles I find in my work is that I would love studies that are showing comparisons of CAFOs to rangeland systems, and there's not anything that's out there. But there are studies showing how pasture systems can sequester much, much more carbon than feedlot systems, obviously, because they're not depending on grain. And there are studies that say that although animals raised on pasture probably produce more methane than animals that are confined in feedlots, because the pasture is sequestering carbon, that that's lowering the total greenhouse gas emissions, and that's very important, but something that's not, it's often overlooked when we're talking about pasture systems, because we're so concerned about methane or the transport or all the other things that are involved in industrial feedlots versus pasture systems. So that's my short answer.
So we were just chatting over here, and she's right, there aren't really data that would give you a definitive answer about the feedlot versus, and because it's questionable, because some, depending on where you're drawing your boundaries, if you're just looking at the actual cow, then eating grass is actually creating more methane, you know, so that some studies are coming out with that result, so it gets even more confusing. But I think the bigger thing is, which is meat in general is a big greenhouse gas producer. So the difference between CAFOs and grass-fed may be less than whether you can eat less meat to start with. So looking at your whole dietary practice might in fact be a more, you know, the overall diet, and changing one's overall diet might be a more effective way of reducing greenhouse gases.
Yes.
Yeah, Jonathan Katz from the University of Wisconsin. This is a follow-up question to the woman in the front row who I thought asked a beautiful question about, you know, what is the message? Is it that pasture fed rather than CAFOs? Or should we start raising ostriches or iguanas instead of cows? Or should we completely get away from meat altogether? There are a lot of many stakeholders, and there are a lot of cattle farmers in this country. What, you know, if we were to engage them, what would the message be? Would it be job retraining, or is there a better way to do this? What do we say to the cattlemen, lords of the American tradition?
Okay. Well, okay, that good question. I think that diversified farming systems are where we want to go. So I don't, you know, I guess I object to, it's not either or for any of this. I think for Americans that are eating the quantity of meat that we're currently eating, we can easily say, let's cut back. That doesn't mean eliminate. We don't all have to become vegetarians. And I think that having animals in a diversified production system is a good thing. I think what we're talking about is the style of agriculture that we have now is not necessarily the thing that we want to keep either, because these confinement feeding operations and so on are not really doing us a good thing for many reasons. Besides the carbon, it has to do with manure management and water safety and quality and so on and so forth. So I think we need to look at the way that our agricultural system is organized, our food and agricultural system. Does that kind of get more at what you're thinking? There's no, like, you know, concrete answer, do this. It's all sort of, in a sense, relative to you know, gradually changing the way that we think about the food system. That's what I was saying. We need to move towards less meat consumption. Yes, we do.
A couple of other, you in the brown or burgundy jacket, and 2, 3, 4. Okay, and then that will be it. Yeah, absolutely. David.
Well, just to respond to John's point, I think part of the answer is to stop thinking about people who raise animals as meat producers. Joel Salatin calls himself a grass farmer, and we need to think of them as biomass producers, where part of what they produce might be meat, might be milk, but it's also biomass that's going to be in the plastics, fossil fuels, biomass that might go for fuel production, or any one of the number of other things. And, but where the research comes in, we can figure out how to do that in a way so it's a net sequestering of carbon, or at least, you know, minimizing the carbon impact. And we haven't done that research yet. Mm-hmm.
That's a good answer.
Did you want to? Maybe you want to?
No. Okay. Go ahead, we'll take a couple more questions. Yeah, you in the back, sorry.
Hi, I'm at the University of Wisconsin Madison. I heard a really interesting talk a couple weeks ago about the whitening of the alternative food system in the States, referring to the fact that that farmers markets have been crop up, strategically placing shelves, not have been crop up in high income communities, because those are people that are willing to pay for local organic. They kind of, you know, say that low income communities don't value local organic. I wondered, and I that's the first time I've really heard it explicitly addressed. So I wondered if this food justice issue, I guess, is something that you guys are talking about, or what you think about it.
No, I'll just briefly say it is a huge issue within the funding community and within the sustainable ag and food systems realm, within the advocacy as well. People are recognizing, and I would say that they are also community activists and people working in low-income communities certainly recognize food deserts where they don't have access to food. They recognize the kind of inequitable food system that currently exists, and they are huge allies. They also get a lot of press right now, but it is, I know it's, in the world that I run in, it's definitely a big, big issue.
Thanks. And I just wanted to add to that by talking about some policy tools that are out there to help change that and make food that's more sustainable also more accessible and affordable. And APHA was very active in working on the Farm Bill and trying to develop some programs through the Farm Bill that would do this. And there's also an upcoming opportunity through the Child Nutrition Reauthorization to try and, again, get more sustainably produced foods out to children throughout the country. It's a huge issue. And
okay, yes.
I'm Bob Lawrence from the Center for Local Future. This is a question for, I think it's a life cycle question, and that is, in Iowa, I saw a scientist told me a year ago that 29 million acres in soybean corn, if they shifted to no-till, sequestered 29 million tons of carbon one time, and then it would stay sequestered. But there would be trade-offs with crop yield and the need for more integrated pest management and so on. Do you know of anybody who's looked at that,
soil sequestration research?
Well, no, the trade-offs, doing the life cycle analysis of going to no-till for all the row crops that we currently produce in this country and what that impact might be on carbon sequestration and the trade-offs, because there are apparently less lower yields.
Mm-hmm. There's one researcher at UC Davis, his name is Johann Six, And I think he's doing some research around that, but it wouldn't be like an analysis of the whole U.S. or anything. It would be like probably for particular crops in, you know, an experimental situation. That's kind of the state of where the research is right now. Is
from what we know, what would you say? Should we be moving to NoTech?
I don't know enough about it to answer that definitively. But that is one thing in that whole lineup of issues that I think probably deserves more attention and would be on the positive side. It wasn't in our top six, but.
Just an interesting point along those lines. So we've talked a lot about life cycle analysis today as applied to food. But there are also life cycle analysis studies that have been done, for example, on corn ethanol, comparing a mix E85, it's 85% ethanol, not made from the corn itself, but made from the stover. It's basically the leftovers that remain after harvesting the corn, the stem and the leaves. And so currently, I don't remember the exact figures, but I know there's a lot of criticism of ethanol as not being energy efficient. However, this life cycle analysis looked at the stover, and the assumption of the life cycle assessment study was that the corn was grown using no-till agriculture. Now, granted, that's not really a realistic assumption because only a very small percentage of corn production, and I actually believe the study was done in Iowa, only a very small percentage of production is done using no-till. However, the study did find that because of the increase in soil CO2 sequestration resulting from using the no-till methods resulted in the ethanol having the environmental impacts were far lesser than that of the equivalent gasoline, same miles drive. However, the trade-off was that by using no-till agriculture, since tilling the soil, as many of you probably know, is one way of eradicating weeds, the life cycle analysis indicated that the ethanol resulted in significant increase of life cycle toxic emissions from increased pesticide and herbicide use. So that's just another one of those trade-offs that you have to consider.
Okay, we're going to have one more. How about three very quick ones?
I think that many of us are reading the literature that's coming out of Europe, so we're echoing reasonably similar messages, and so there's not a strong singular message, although the eat less meat message, I think, is pretty consistent across. But in the new literature review that I mentioned from Tara Garnett at the Food Climate Research Network, she has an excellent kind of table that ranks a whole bunch of different actions on high, medium, and low priority. And I think that's sort of one of the key messages that's coming out of Europe, but it's not necessarily more consistent than what's coming out of here. They've got more advanced numbers specific to their system, but we're all reading together. Thanks.
Yeah, you and then you.
Great, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. It's been a great presentation today. Just kind of question, we've been talking a lot about cattle, and I'm just curious about what's the relative level of emissions from other game animals or poultry and whatnot. So when we're saying telling them to eat less meat, is it
ruminants
across the board or just red meat?
Ruminants is the main thing.
Yeah, right. That's the focus. But again, there's a lack of data. I would love to see greenhouse gas studies from CAFOs, you know, for chicken and pork and other types of meat, and we don't know for wild game and that sort of thing, but again, it's a lack of data issue on other animals.
Yep. Okay. No, well.
Is everyone familiar with ruminant?
Yes.
I wasn't before I joined CLM, so everyone knows what that means.
Does everyone know what a CAFO is? Confined, yeah, see, I should squirt all of you.
Sorry.
Confined animal feeding operation. And they are, they have biohazard signs going in. You have to shower going in, you have to shower going out. One of the most interesting statistics that really stuck in my mind, I went on a tour de manure in southeastern Minnesota. It was great. And they have 30,000, we weren't allowed in, but we went by turkey operations, and they have 30,000 to 35,000 birds under one roof. And in that part of the country, with winter storms and ice storms, oftentimes the electricity goes out. And I was told that if the generator doesn't come on within 15 minutes, they lose the entire flock. So you're talking 30 to 35,000 turkeys, you know, early turkey dinner. But those are the kind of feeding operations. Hogs are the same thing. I know all over the Southeast in particular, there's huge animal operations. Gee, we're ending on such a positive note. I would like to ask you to join me in thanking the presenters.